Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host, Jimmy Akin, our guest for this hour, as last hour. It's good to have Jimmy for two. You know, it's awful nice to have Jimmy for 2 hours, but to have it on a Friday, that's a bonus. And Friday heading into, some people like to get the week off. Some people work till Wednesday. We're working till Wednesday, right, Darren? Any chance we could rethink that? We gotta. Oh, Darren is willing to rethink it. All right, fair enough. Well, so we'll either be on the air or not next week. I'll just leave that there. We're either going to be here or not. I'm not going to give out the phone number because...
Spoilers, we're going to be here.
Oh, Jimmy, come on. I thought there might be a meeting where I could get my way for once. And we would just have a full Thanksgiving week off. I am... I think I'm in the minority on this, Jimmy, as an American. I think we should have more federal holidays. I don't know why Americans are so resistant to having more holidays.
I don't think that you're in the minority.
Oh, you don't? Oh, okay.
People would love to have more paid holidays.
Okay. Oh, all right. That's good to hear that. I had too low an opinion of my fellow Americans. But we need some in August. Is there anything historical that happened in August that we can have a holiday around? We go through
federal level?
Yeah.
I'm sure that if you go through a today in history calendar for August, you will find something you can use as an excuse.
If you have a question, just ask Jimmy Akin. That's a good policy. If you have a question, just ask Jimmy Akin. And you know what? Let's do that for the whole hour today. We'll just go through
a calendar of what happened today.
No, ask you questions. We're going to spend the next hour asking you questions. Mm-hmm. It's an internet open forum. All the questions have come, as you could probably guess, from the internet. Jimmy Akin, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and a whole bunch of other things. And here to answer questions, and this one comes from Marty. What was the thorn in Paul's side?
Well, we don't know for sure. Paul refers at one point to having a thorn in his side that God gave him to keep him from becoming too self-important. And so it's kind of keeping him humble. And the answer is we really don't know. He doesn't give us enough information. Presumably, people in Paul's circle would have known what he was talking about, and probably the Corinthians that he was writing to about this, they may well have known what it was also. But here's a nice little summary from Colin Cruz in the Tyndale New Testament commentary. Many suggestions have been made concerning the nature of Paul's thorn in the flesh. They include, 1, some form of spiritual harassment, for example, the limitations of a nature corrupted by sin, the torments of temptation, or oppression by a demon. 2, persecution, for example, that instigated by Jewish opposition or by Paul's Christian opponents. 3, some physical or mental ailment, for example, eye trouble, meaning trouble with his eyes, attacks of malarial fever, stammering speech, epilepsy, headaches, or a neurological disturbance. 4, the Corinthian church's rejection of his apostleship, or some of them rejected it. However, the plain fact, according to Cruz, is that there is insufficient data to decide the matter. Most modern interpreters prefer to see it as some sort of physical ailment, and the fact that Paul calls it a thorn in the flesh offers some support for this. Galatians 4:15 is appealed to by those who want to identify it as an eye problem. So if you look up in Galatians 4, Paul is talking to them, and he's recalling how he first met the Galatians, and he says, "You know that I first preached the gospel among you on account of an illness." So he was traveling through the region of Galatia when he got sick and had to stop. And he then makes a comment. He's contrasting the attitude that they took towards him back then with the somewhat more distant attitude that some of them are taking right now, the ones who want to be circumcised. And he's going to call them back to behaving towards him like they did back when he first met them. And he says, I testify to you that you would have given me your very own eyes. Now, that could just be a rhetorical flourish, because we would be very reluctant to part with our eyes. And back then, they didn't have the technology to do eye transplants. We do today, but they didn't then. And so, so it could just be an extreme example of willingness to help someone else. But it may not mean anything more than that. On the other hand, it may mean something more than that. He may be indicating something about the nature of the sickness that prevented him from traveling. It may have been a flare-up of an eye disease like ophthalmia. And so he may have been traveling along, and then his eyes flare up and he's got to stop, and he meets various Galatians and starts preaching the gospel to them. So that's a possibility. It may be that St. Paul had eye trouble or some other physical ailment, and that's what the thorn was. Or it could be something else, because he does talk about God giving him a messenger of Satan to torment him. And so it could be spiritual harassment, or they could be the same thing, because demons do sometimes cause physical ailments in people. And so the answer, we don't know, but there are some possibilities.
All right. Thank you very much for unintentionally, but getting us started, Marty, this hour. It's an internet open forum, and this one comes from Ryan. When I cited John chapter 20, verses 21 through 23 as clear evidence for sacramental confession, a Protestant made a claim that the power granted by Christ in those passages died with the apostles. One, how would you respond? Two, do you know where this claim came from?
In regard to how I would respond, I would point out, so this passage in John 20 is where it's right after the, or shortly after the resurrection. Jesus comes to the disciples, he breathes on them and says, as my Father sent me, so I send you. He breathes on them and says, receive the Holy Spirit. Whoever sins you forgive, they are forgiven. Whoever sins you retain, they are retained. So he's given them the power to forgive and retain sins. Well, okay, that's useful. That's good to have. We want our sins forgiven. And there are people who need to not have them forgiven if they haven't repented. So it makes sense that Jesus would give them this ability, which he had previously displayed in his own ministry. That's why he says, as my Father sent me, so I send you. God sent him to do this, and now he's commissioning them to do this. Okay, so Psychelet, quick question.
Mm-hmm.
How long has sin been a problem in human history?
Since Adam and Eve.
And how long has sin been a problem since the ministry of Christ?
The whole time.
So you're telling me sin didn't stop after the apostolic age?
From personal experience, I know that it did not stop with the apostolic age.
Okay, so if Jesus thought it was important to empower his ministers to forgive or retain sins in the apostolic age to deal with the problem of sin, and if there is no statement that this, and there isn't, that this ability is going to vanish at some point, and if the problem that motivated him to give this ability continued, if there's still going to be a problem with sin after the apostolic age, there's still going to be a need for this ministry he gave, and there's nothing that says it's going to stop. So that's how I'd respond. I would say he gave the church this ability because they were going to need it. We still need it. He doesn't say we're not going to have it. Therefore, we do still have it. Do I know where the claim came from? Well, I can't name a specific individual who thought up this claim. I have encountered variants of it before, but basically they are all ad hoc, meaning just for this reason, come up with. There are various ad hoc arguments to try to neutralize what the passage says. So here the respondent doesn't want to say, well, it doesn't mean what you think. He's willing to concede the apostles did have this ability. But he wants to say it died with them, even though that's not in this passage, and even though there is a continuing need that's just as strong now as it was in the apostolic age to have this faculty. So it's basically a deduction from the fact that they don't believe, they're committed, the people who use this argument, are committed to the idea that the sacrament of confession is not real, but here we have something that would involve the sacrament of confession, and therefore, to try to maintain their position that the sacrament is not real today, they deduce that it must have ceased with the death of the apostles, even though that's not what the passage says, and even though, and notice this isn't specifically the apostles either, it's Christ's ministers, because John's gospel doesn't even use the term apostles. We know that the term John uses is disciples, and some of the disciples Jesus had were not apostles, but he still commissioned them to minister, like in the case of the 72. So so this claim is a deduction designed to rescue the prior commitment that the sacrament of confession is not real today. But that begs the question, and this text provides evidence that it does exist and therefore should exist today, since we don't have a retirement of it and since we still have the problem.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much for the question, Ryan. Appreciate it. It's an internet open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more questions for Jimmy on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Speaking with Deacon has Deacon Harold Burke Sivers and Mark Griffin discussing strategies that will empower us to announce the gospel of the Lord daily through our words and deeds. You can hear Speaking with Deacon as well as faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates across the nation, all in one place, all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTNradio.net/podcasts today.
Back to Catholic Answers Live. The fall store-wide sale is going on over at shop.catholic.com. 10 to 25% off everything. Some things more than 25% off, including courses in our School of Apologetics. So check it all out at shop.catholic.com. Gloria asked this question, Jimmy. At Pentecost, tongues of fire rested on those present, and they spoke in foreign languages, foreign tongues. Is this a play on words? In other languages, especially in Greek, is the word for an anatomical tongue the same as the word for a slice of fire? Even without a play on words, the coming from unknown source of fire often signified the presence of God. So the point of the phenomenon doesn't really rely on, at least in English, the play on words, does it?
Okay, so what I can tell you is a couple things. The first one is the word for tongue in many languages is also the word for language, because we use our tongues to make language. In fact, even the word language, it's derived from the same, from a different root, but a root that also means tongue. And so So English kind of got, because English has this weird double vocabulary, it tends to have at least two words for everything. And so tongue can mean either the organ in your mouth, or it can mean a language like the French tongue or the English tongue. And we also have the word language for tongue in the second sense. And language itself comes from a root that also means tongue. Well, specifically in Greek, the word tongue also in English can mean things like an individual flame, a tongue of fire.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that common a usage these days, but we recognize that if someone talks about tongues of fire were leaping up around the log, we would know what that meant. Same thing in Greek. In Greek, the word tongue can refer to the organ in your mouth. It can refer to language, which you produce using the organ in your mouth, and it can refer to a flame, to an individual flame, because, you know, flames look kind of like long
Latin
stretched
tongues.
Out tongues.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it can do that in Greek. And in fact, if you look at the Greek text of Acts 2, where the account of Pentecost is found, it says that glossa of fire appeared and divided and rested on each of them. And then it says they spoke with other glossae. So it's the same word.
Oh, yeah.
The glossae or tongues of fire appeared on their foreheads, and then they spoke with other glossae, meaning other languages. And so, yes, this is exactly what's going on in the Greek.
Oh, Gloria, nice job picking up on that. Let's go to a question from Teresa. Teresa asks this, Jimmy. My husband died in June of brain cancer 5 months after diagnosis. So many good people keep telling me that he's in a better place. Why do they say that when it should be obvious that he should be with me? I understand that we can't know for certain where a soul goes after death. How do I respond to this? It makes me angry at how easily people toss that cliche out to a woman who is grieving the death of her husband.
Well, first of all, Teresa, I want to say I'm very sorry to hear about your husband's death, and I understand where you're coming from, because I'm a widower too. You're a widow, I'm a widower. My wife died a number of years ago of colon cancer, and she died just 1 month after we had a diagnosis. So we only knew what it was for a month, and then she died. And I went through a very intense grieving period after that. In part, you know, we were both very young. We were both like 27 at the time, and you don't expect to lose a spouse at that age. It's one thing if you're both in your 70s or 80s to lose a spouse. It's still tragic and sad even at that age, but it's shocking when it happens so young. And so I had a very intense phase of grieving that went on for quite a while. And I know what it's like to miss a spouse and to want them to be there with you, and how people try to address the situation in conversation when they talk to you. And the thing is, it's never easy when you know someone. I mean, for someone like me who has lost a spouse, it's a little easier to know what to say. But for people who have not had that experience, it's harder to figure out what to say. And they want to be comforting. They want to find a way to ease your suffering, at least most of the time. But they're not sure how to do that. And one of the things they fall back on is the understanding that, you know, when we die, we go to be with God. And when we're with God, we're not going to be suffering. We're going to be in the joy of heaven. Now, as Catholics, we know there can be a preliminary phase where we get cleaned up in purgatory, which is not all sweetness and light, but it's temporary. And so when people end up with God, they're going to be happy, and they're not going to have the problems and the suffering that we have in this life. And so that has resulted in, and it is cliche, as you say it is, in this cliche of speaking of a dead person as being in a better place, meaning a place where they don't have the challenges and the suffering and the experiences that we have in this life. And so that's what they're trying. And of course, since this is a Protestant country, historically speaking, most people have been Protestants, they don't really think about purgatory. So they tend to assume if you die, you're just instantly with God, you're instantly in a better place with no intermediate state. Well, what they're trying to do when they say this is they're trying to be comforting. They're trying to give you a sense of hope that your husband is no longer suffering. He may have suffered terribly during his final illness, but he's not suffering now. He's in a better place in the sense that he's not having to go through that anymore. And so that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to bring a sense of comfort and hope to you in the midst of the grief. They're not necessarily trying to take the grief away, but they're trying to give you an element of comfort and hope. And that's what they mean. So in this kind of situation, now I'm as analytical as anybody. In fact, I'm more analytical than most people. And if people had been coming up to me in the immediate wake of my wife's death and saying, your wife is in a better place, I could have critiqued that and say, well, number one, she could be in purgatory. She might actually be suffering more now than she was during her illness. How do you know? Or I could say, well, her place is to be here with me, and that would be the better place for her. I could analyze it in those terms, and I understand the tendency to do that, and I understand the frustration with people who repeat cliches and don't seem to think about it further. And I understand all of that, but what I would urge you to do, to the extent you can, is appreciate what they're trying to do. It's an awkward, uncomfortable situation, and they don't want to pretend it doesn't exist. They don't want to just ignore it. They want to address it somehow. And the only way that some people know how, secondly, they want to give you some kind of comfort and hope. And the only way they know how to do that is by using this better place cliche. So I would say, rather than focusing on the cliche itself, I would focus on the intent of the people who use it, and that they're, even if it's clumsy, they're trying to be a friend. They're trying to provide you with comfort and hope.
Thank you very much for the question, Teresa. I do indeed hope that was helpful to you. It's an open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Christine wants to know this, Jimmy. Does the church have a preferred stance on Darwinism versus Lamarckism?
Okay, so we should define both of these terms for people who may not be familiar with them. Now, almost everyone's going to be familiar with Darwin. Charles Darwin is credited, or these days co-credited, because another guy kind of thought it up at the same time, with a popular understanding of the theory of evolution, according to which there are random changes in an organism, or as we would say today, random mutations in an organism that then pass through a process known as natural selection. Whereas, so that if the random mutation benefits the organism, if it makes it easier for that organism to survive and reproduce, then that will get passed on, that will be selected for just naturally. It's going to survive better, it's going to reproduce better, and so that will result in that trait being passed on to the organism's offspring. Whereas if the trait doesn't do anything, which actually most random mutations don't do anything, it may or may not get passed on. And if it positively harms the organism, if it makes it less likely for the organism to survive or to reproduce, well, then it's not going to get passed on because the organism's going to die before it can reproduce. And so you have this selection of characteristics of random mutations that tend to favor the organism. Those are the ones that get passed down. Okay, so that's how Darwin's understanding of the theory of evolution works. But before Darwin, there was another guy named Lamarck. And Lamarck proposed a different understanding of evolution, because Darwin was not the first guy to talk about evolution. He was the guy who kind of settled on a major theory that came to dominate. But before his time, there was this guy named Lamarck. And Lamarck had a somewhat different understanding of how things get passed down. Lamarck thought that there was a kind of memory that organisms have of what characteristics they use. And if they use a given characteristic, that's going to get passed down. So, for example, on a Lamarckian account, one of the ways that giraffes might get longer necks is the giraffe grandparents would stretch their necks really high to reach those leaves. And they got so used to stretching their neck up high to reach those leaves that their offspring had slightly longer necks. And then the giraffe parents, they would stretch their necks too to reach the leaves. And that got passed down to their kids. And so over a number of generations of giraffes purposefully stretching, they ended up with longer necks. So that's a basic explanation of how, it's kind of simplified, but it's a basic explanation of how the Lamarckian understanding of evolution works. So that brings us to the question that you asked, Kristen. Does the church have a preferred stance on either of these theories of evolution? I'll tell you on the other side of the break.
That's almost as good as a demons or aliens tease, a Lamarck or Darwinism tease. We'll continue with Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an open forum. And Christine wanted to know if the church prefers Darwinism over Lamarckism or the reverse. Jimmy, you were in the midst of an answer.
Yeah, so Darwinism basically says that these mutations that get passed down are just random. There's no real purpose in them. And the ones that happen to benefit the organisms, they get passed down. Whereas Lamarckism says, nah, it's more purposeful than that. It's the things that you use, that organisms can make little changes in themselves. And if they're using them, that's going to get passed down. So that's the key difference. Now, these are scientific theories, and consequently, the church does not have a preference between them because the church does not have preferences on matters of science. That's not a matter of teaching. What the church's job is to teach us the deposit of faith, which is the faith passed down from Christ and the apostles. These are not matters of faith, and so consequently, the church is neutral regarding them. Neither one of these is heretical. Neither one of these is anything like that. So this is a matter for science to figure out. And the church would be happy if the Darwinistic understanding of evolution is true. The church would be happy if the Lamarckian understanding of evolution is true. The church would be happy if no theory of evolution ended up being true. It leaves these matters to science. So what can we say about science? What is it found on this question? Well, for basically all of the 20th century. Now, Darwin published in the 1800s, and his theory quickly became very popular. And for the 20th century, basically everyone went with Darwin and said Lamarck was wrong. They didn't see any way for an animal's behavior or other organisms, because evolution happens to plants and fungi and so forth too. They didn't see any way for an organism's behavior to create a characteristic that it could pass down to its offspring. And so you would think, well, if there's no way for that to happen, then any mutations there are must just be random, which is what Darwin said. Mm-hmm. But recently, turns out Lamarck wasn't so wrong. There are characteristics that you can create in a living organism, not by varying its genes, that will be passed down. For example, there have been experiments done with mice where you put mice in an environment where they're going to receive periodic electrical shocks. And every time they get an electrical shock, you release the scent of orange blossom, or actually cherry blossom.
Okay.
In the experiment. So every time they get a hit of electricity, they also get hit with the scent of cherry blossom. And over time, as we would expect from Dr. Pavlov's experiments with his dogs, which were way grosser than we hear about, they learn to fear the scent of cherry blossom because they associate it with being given an electrical shock. And then you let the mice, as they say in The Incredibles, get busy. And their children, who have never been given an electric shock, are still terrified of the scent of cherry blossom.
What?
And this will last for generations.
What?
And so the fear of cherry blossom is something you can induce in one generation of mice, and it will be passed on. So how does this work? Well, it's not affecting the genetics of the mice. Instead, it's affecting what are known as their epigenetics. Epigenetics determine which genes are turned on or turned off during a given generation. And epigenetics can be changed purposefully in a single generation, and epigenetics can be passed on. So you're not changing the genes of the mice when you make them fear cherry blossoms. Instead, you're changing which genes are turned on, and that status of being turned on or turned off is also heritable. So the children will have the fear, even though they're genetically the same as their parents, they're going to be born with the fear of cherry blossom because they have the same epigenetic settings. And so it turns out that in the last few decades, science has been drifting towards a fusion of Darwinism and Lamarckianism, where it's recognized that both of them have a role to play in how traits are inherited by organisms.
Well, what do you know? That came around, didn't it? Christine, thank you. Thank you very, very much for the question. Susan asks this, Jimmy. The Bible, well, it's got some description before it gets to a question. The Bible is a Catholic book, right? The Bible is a Catholic book, right? Besides dropping the deuterocanonical books, have Protestants in the English-speaking world mistranslated words? Like the word tradition, which in the Spanish version is translated as tradition when it is in a negative sense, traditions of men, and as teaching when it's favorable. Is there any in English?
Yeah, there is translator bias, and this affects everyone. It doesn't just affect Protestants, but it does affect Protestants. And I can think of two prominent examples right off the top of my head. One of them is the one you named. There are Protestant Bibles that, in order to make tradition sound bad, they translate the Greek word for tradition as tradition whenever it's referred to negatively, and they translate the Greek word for tradition as something like teaching whenever, or teachings, whenever it's referred to positively. And what that does is it presents the reader of this Protestant translation with a distorted impression of how the New Testament treats tradition. Because you only hear the word tradition in a negative context. You never hear it in a positive context, even though the New Testament uses it in a positive context. And so it's a slant. Now, this is a minor thing, but it does happen. The other example that readily springs to mind is, and this is, again, because English has this double vocabulary where, you know, we have this word saint, but it means the same thing as holy one. A saint is a whole, is someone who's holy. And one of them, sanctus, saint, comes from Latin, and holy comes from German. So we got these two words for the same thing. Well, one of the theological distinctives of Protestantism at the time of the Reformation and still today is they wanted to emphasize that we're all saints. And that there's nothing, this is the problem, that there's nothing special about the saints in heaven. We don't need to pay attention to them. We shouldn't be praying to them. We shouldn't be asking them for their intercession. And we here on earth are just as saintly as everybody in heaven. Ish. Well, what happened or has happened in various Protestant English translations, and going back all the way to the King James, if I'm not mistaken, is whenever the Hebrew or Greek terms for saint apply to a living human being, it gets translated saint. And whenever it applies to anything other than a normal living human being, it gets translated holy one. And what this does is it masks the fact that angels are also saints, because it'll talk about God coming with his holy ones, meaning his angels. And it masks that. It also results in us not noticing people in heaven being described as saints because they're called holy ones. And it even masks God and Christ from being called saints, because God is the Holy One of Israel, or the Saint of Israel, and Jesus is the Holy One of God, or the Saint of God. But whenever we have people here on earth who are called holy in the Greek or the Hebrew, that gets translated saint, because they really want to emphasize that living Christians are saints, which is true, but not to the exclusion of these other things. And by using holy one in other contexts, it masks the breadth of who actually would count as a saint. So yes, the same thing does happen. Fortunately, these are minor things, and minor translation issues like that. No Bible is perfect, and these are pretty minor in the scope of things. So it doesn't end up causing a big problem. And the good news is I can report, if I'm not mistaken, that some of them have actually fixed some of these problems. My memory is that an earlier edition of the Protestant translation, known as the New International Version, did the traditions versus teaching thing. But if memory serves, they fixed that now in newer ones, and they translated as tradition more consistently. So that may be a result of dialogue on this issue and people pointing out, hey, you're being selective in how you're doing this translation.
Susanna, thank you very much for the question. That brings us to the break. We'll take that break and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives.
The year was 2005. EWTN embraces new technology to carry out its mission of evangelization by making its live programs and classic broadcasts available for podcast online in MP3 format at no charge.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. On the Friday before Thanksgiving week, we have here in the United States, if you're listening around the world, Thanksgiving week, big week, big travel week, and a big eating week, and a big football week, sports ball, if you prefer. And we're heading into that this weekend, and we're doing an internet open forum this hour with Jimmy. And this is a question from Ryan, who may well be a parrot head, based on the question. Ryan asked this. Jimmy Buffett's song, Coastal Confessions, has a line, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. Given the chance, I'll probably do it again." Would this make the confession null, since it seems Jimmy hasn't fully repented, or is it just honesty / humility?
Well, the answer, it could be either one. On the one hand, we do need to repent of our sins in the sense that we don't want to do them again. We're going to try to keep from doing them again, and we're going to trust in God's grace to help us keep from doing them again. But we also have experience that shows us, at least for certain sins, we're likely to fall into them again at some point. We're likely to get tempted and give into that temptation and make a mistake. And so the church has had to think carefully about this question, and moral theologians have considered it for centuries. And it's universally recognized today that you do not have to repent in such a way that you are guaranteeing you are never going to sin again. If that was required, then almost no confessions would be valid. And you wouldn't need them more than once. You wouldn't need to go to confession more than once. So it is recognized that because of human frailty, you don't have to promise a sinless future. It is therefore quite possible for someone to say, I'm probably, just knowing my own history, I'm probably going to do this again. But I don't want to. Right now, at the time of confession, my will is turned away from that sin. I reject it. I do not want to do that right now. I may even be tempted to do it right now, but on the level of my will, I'm excluding it right now. And so in this moment, I'm excluding this sin. And so I intend, to the best of my ability, not to do that again. And that's sufficient for a valid confession. And so if that's the state of a person, then even if they foresee that this is based on the King James Version, is called a besetting sin, something that tends to happen to you over and over again, it'll still be valid as long as at the moment you're being absolved, you exclude it by an act of the will. And you know, could say something like, if God so wills, I just want this out of my life, you know, and I'd love to be cured of this temptation right now and never do this again. On the other hand, someone may not have that resolution. They may want absolution, but they're like, you know, I'm really planning on doing this. I'm not excluding it by an act of the will. I'm actually expecting to do this, and not just expecting, because simple experience will let you predict should you expect to do this in the future or not. But I'm looking forward to it. I'm planning on doing this again. I haven't really rejected it. So Jimmy Buffett's lyric is ambiguous. It could be just honesty and humility based on his knowledge of his own self and his history. Or it could be a sign that he hasn't really repented. It could be either one. And so we don't have we don't have a way, and I'm not familiar with this song, but at least based on what Ryan quoted, I don't have a way to distinguish between those two options. And Buffett may mean it to be ambiguous, which one he means, for artistic reasons. He may not want it to be clear whether he has repented or whether he hasn't. Sometimes in drama, including dramas in songs, ambiguity can add to the artistic presentation of the material, where you're not sure and you got to think about it and you got to wonder, is he really repented or has he not? And that can make the song more interesting. In any event, that's what I'd have to say about that. And there is actually confirmation of what I just said in a document that came out from the Vatican during the reign of John Paul II. It's called the Vatimecum for Confessors. Vatimecum, it's Latin. It means go with me. And so the idea of a Vatimecum is a little document. It's like a little handbook. You stick it in your pocket. You take it with you on a journey. So this is a Vatimecum for Confessors about how to deal with certain questions in the confessional regarding sexual sins and related issues. And one of the points it makes is that the penitent does not have to promise a sinless future. They can recognize they're likely to fall into this again in the future. But the key thing is they're not, at this moment, they are willing not to do that.
Ryan, thank you very, very much for the question. On we go. Just a little bit of time left for questions. So Christine has this one. I believe this is directly for you, Jimmy. Where did your Mexican serape blanket that you drape over your chair come from?
Oh, okay. Well, this is something that people who watch videos of Catholic Answers Live will see. I'm here in my home office, and I do indeed have a serape, which is a kind of Mexican blanket, on the chair behind me, because it's just a black chair. It's not very interesting to look at. And I like Southwestern decor, and so I have a serape on it. In terms of where did my Mexican serape blanket come from? Mexico? I don't know. Actually, it reminds me of the Nickelodeon cartoon series, The Fairly Odd Parents. I don't know if you ever saw that, Psychelet.
I feel like I might have seen that, yeah.
It's about a little boy named Timmy who has two fairy godparents who grant him wishes, because everyone treats him like dirt. And so they give him wishes so he won't be completely sad. And he wishes for all these amazing things. And then since it's a comedy series, other people see him with the amazing things. And they will ask questions like, Timmy, where did you get that time-traveling motor scooter that crawls up walls? Because that's what he's just wished for. But he can't let anyone know about his godparents or they'll vanish forever. So he's got to lie in those situations. And his answer is always the same. So whether it's, Timmy, where did you get that fire-breathing elephant that can cure cancer? Or whatever it is, he's going to say, Internet. And that happens to be the answer in the question of this particular serape. I got it on Amazon. That's where it came from.
Well,
I have many other serapes though that I use for decor. And I'll tell you a little story. 30 years ago, when I moved to California, my dad and I drove out, and we stopped for the night at a hotel that had a restaurant gift shop attached. And it was either in New Mexico or Arizona. And when I got up in the morning, I went out to the gift shop, the restaurant, to have breakfast, and they had serapes on sale. And I found this one that was really cool. And so I bought it and I took it to San Diego with me. And for many years, I had it on the wall facing across from my bed. And during those years, I developed cataracts in both eyes. And they went on for so long that when I had cataract surgery, they weren't sure if I was going to have restored depth perception. Because my eyes had been out of sync for so long. Well, I wanted depth perception. I wanted stereoscopic vision. And so I said, I'm not going to accept that I'm not going to get it back. So what I would do, there were these white diamond shapes on the serape I had on the wall in front of me. And so I would practice laying in bed and crossing my eyes in such a way that I would maneuver the diamond shapes on top of each other. And then I would tell me, these two diamond shapes that I'm seeing are the same shape. I'm just seeing them through different eyes. So I'd force the diamonds to align and then tell myself, this is the same thing. And one morning, as I was doing that, it clicked, and suddenly I could see the serape and everything else in 3D again. The next thing I looked at, I raised my arm, and I could see it and the hairs on it in 3D. And so I retrained myself to have stereoscopic vision with that serape. Well, so then I moved back to Arkansas this summer. And as I'm coming back through Arkansas, or through the desert Southwest, I stop in New Mexico. And there's a place, there are loads of places selling serapes, but I found one that I really liked, and it was kind of similar to the one I bought 30 years ago. So I bought one 30 years ago on my way to California. Oh. I bought another on my way back to Arkansas. And when I got here, I used them both as pieces of decor. I framed the 30 year ago one on the left side of a doorway and the recent one on the right side of a doorway. And so I have the coming and the going serapes on the side of a doorway, which represents transition from one point to another.
It kind of represents your 30 years out here in California. Yeah. Well, Christine, thank you very much for that interesting question. We got time for another one. So this one comes from Anthony. What do you think about the Gospel of the Hebrews? Later patchwork of... Wait, somebody moved my words here. What do you think about the Gospel of the Hebrews? Later patchwork of reworked quotes from the Synoptics? Something contemporary with the Synoptics? A Hebrew version of Matthew? Could it ever be rediscovered?
Well, so there are several different Gospels that were used by early Hebrew Christians and early Hebrew Christian heretics. There's the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Gospel of the Nazarenes. There are several like this. And it's often hard to tell which one is being referred to in a given church father. We don't have any of these, or at least we think we don't. We do have some Hebrew translations of the Gospels, but most scholars have concluded that they are later translations and don't go all the way back to the time that the Gospel of the Hebrews or these others do. Although that's debated. There, you know, it could be someone could come along and mount a convincing case that one of them is one of these originals, but they look like they're later translations to most scholars. We do know that this gospel, the Gospel of the Hebrews, continued to be in circulation into the 4th century because it's mentioned by Eusebius of Caesarea, the father of church history, as one of the books that is disputed among Christians. He notes that it's not one of the ones that everyone agrees belongs in the canon, and it's not one of the ones that everyone believes doesn't belong in the canon. He says it's valued by Hebrew Christians. And so that could suggest that this was orthodox and not completely identical to like Matthew. We also have a few quotations from it. And if we're correct about this is the Hebrew gospel being referred to, it would indicate it's more than just a translation of Matthew, because it has some stuff in it that Matthew does not have. Off the top of my head, there's a quotation where Jesus refers to the Holy Spirit as his mother, which is what you might expect, given that the word for spirit is feminine in Aramaic. St. Jerome, after he went to Bethlehem, wrote that he had gotten a copy of the Gospel of the Hebrews and had actually translated it, presumably into Latin. And unfortunately, it hasn't survived, so we don't have that. Could it one day be rediscovered? Yes, it could be. There are loads of manuscripts that have been found in libraries that are not yet classified and published. We also dig up new manuscripts periodically. And it's possible that we could get a copy of it and figure out whether it's a fresh composition, a reworked version of the Synoptics, or something else. And I hope we do, because I'd love to know.
Yeah, yeah. And as we've said before, there's just so much wonderful scholarship and science going on with ancient manuscripts. You never know what's going to come out anytime these days. So lots of good reason to hope. Well, Jimmy... I hope you have a happy Thanksgiving week. I'll probably see you again, but
I sure hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I won't see you again in this life, in all likelihood. But I meant before Thanksgiving. But in case I don't, have a happy Thanksgiving.
Likewise, and to all the listeners.
And that we will be here despite my smart aleck behavior earlier. We will be here next week. So all new shows next week for Thanksgiving week. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.